The father of English poetry, Geoffrey Chaucer, was born in about 1340. The century in which he lived and wrote was an eventful one, and the life of the English people was full of contrasts. Pageantry was offset by poverty, robust vigour by crippling disease, elegant literature by widespread illiteracy. England in the 14th century, as a chronicler of the day wrote, was full of mirth and game, and of men oft-times able to mirth and game, free men of heart and with tongue. The 14th century was also an age dominated by war. King Edward's soldiers sailed across the Channel to fight for English possessions in France, fully confident that England is a strong land and a sturdy, and the plenteousest corner of the world, so rich a land that scarcely it needeth the help of any land, and every other land needeth the help of England. But the long duration of the Hundred Years' War against France was sapping England's strength. Heavy taxes were levied by the king to pay for the army and for the release of captured soldiers. Chaucer himself was taken prisoner during a campaign in France in 1360, and Edward III contributed towards his ransom of £16. In the mid-14th century, many people died from the Black Death, a plague which swept through England. A survivor describes how in 1348, the dreadful pestilence penetrated the seacoast by Southampton and came to Bristol, and there almost the whole population of the town perished, as if it had been seized by sudden death. Few kept their beds more than 2 or 3 days, or even half a day. Then this cruel death spread everywhere around, following the course of the sun. This pestilence lasted almost a whole year. When the aged Edward III died in 1377, the crown passed to his young grandson, Richard II, whose reign began and ended in disaster. While many of England's strong leaders were abroad, unrest broke out amongst the oppressed classes. In 1381, the peasants marched on London and were halted only by an appeal from the king. Eighteen years later, Richard, a weak but tyrannical king, was deposed by his cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, who became Henry IV. This picture shows Richard surrendering to Henry at Flint Castle. Henry's action was sanctioned by the people, for the English will never love or honour their king unless he be victorious and a lover of arms and war against their neighbours. Chaucer served under three English kings, Edward III, Richard II, and Henry IV. As a young man, he was an esquire to Edward III, and his early poetry was written for elegant audiences like the one he is reading to here. As a minor diplomat and official, Chaucer became acquainted with the life of the aristocracy and the fashionable literature of courtly love. An aspiring poet, he translated the French poem, The Romance of the Rose, and wrote short pieces such as The Book of the Duchess. To his contemporaries, Chaucer was the flower of poets throughout all Britain, for he excelled in depicting the ideals and pageantry of aristocratic society. In Chaucer's time, knights still jousted in tournaments to test their prowess and to win the love of their ladies. One of the finest examples of Chaucer's courtly style of writing was the Knight's Tale, whose heroes embodied the moral virtues of chivalry, truth and honour, generosity and courtesy. The glory and ideals of the Crusades, for which kings had taken up arms against the infidels in the Holy Land, still lingered in men's thoughts. Religion was a dominant force, and it was customary for those who could not travel to Jerusalem to make pilgrimages to nearer shrines. In 1170, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, was treacherously murdered in his cathedral. His death was soon followed by his canonization, and for many years afterwards, Canterbury was the goal of pilgrims. Thus, a pilgrimage to the shrine of St. Thomas provided the artistic unity of the Canterbury Tales. From every shire's end, of Engolon to Canterbury they wend, the holy, blissful martyr for to seek, that him hath holpen one that they were seek. Chaucer's pilgrims assembled at the Tabard Inn in Southwark, just across London Bridge. Beneath London Bridge, with its top-heavy cluster of houses, the River Thames was a busy waterway, where many a barge doth sail and row with oar, where many a ship doth rest with top royal. It was here, in the Port of London, that Chaucer worked for 12 years as Controller of Customs. His duties as Controller of Customs were mainly concerned with the revenue from wool, England's chief export, and they brought him into close contact with people other than those of the courtly class. For his last and greatest work, the Canterbury Tales, Chaucer drew upon tradesmen and guildsmen, clerics, doctors and farm labourers to create his pilgrims. The framework of the Canterbury Tales enabled Chaucer to combine his skill as a storyteller with his relish for the details of daily life. By using the pilgrims as his narrators, he could move through the whole of society and emphasize the contrasts within it. By means of this device, Chaucer introduces those at the high table of a noble's house, as well as those in the kitchen quarters who must prepare the meals. People of means, like the Franklin, were expected to be hospitable, and so the quantities of food consumed in a single day were likely to be large. Chaucer's cook, who is seen here, was kept busy roasting and broiling, baking bread from flour ground by the miller, and making meat pasties. Chaucer shows more knowledge of the middle class of merchants and professional men than of those who worked in the kitchens, shops, or on the land. At the same time, he recognized that England's economy depended on her agriculture. The life of those who labored to scratch a living from the land was hard, and their comforts meager. Bread and milk, an occasional piece of bacon, and sometime an egg or two, were all that the poor widow in the nun's priest's tale could afford. William Langland, a contemporary of Chaucer's, gives a vivid account of the hardships endured by such people in his poem Piers Plowman. Some put themselves to the plough and played but seldom. In planting and sowing they labored full hard. Despite famine, flood, and plague, the seasonal round of tilling the land, sowing, and harvesting had to continue. But Chaucer's ploughman was not only a good worker, he was also a man who lived in peace, loving God and his neighbor. His most menial tasks were undertaken willingly, for he wold a thresh, and thereto dyke and delve for Christ's sake. The ploughman's brother in the Canterbury Tales is the good parson. Chaucer gives unconditional praise to the diligent parson, showing how, though poor in material goods, he is rich in holy thought and work. But Chaucer also realizes that his parson is exceptional, and that among the other pilgrims, the friar, summoner, and pardoner are a scurrilous lot. And Madame Eglantine is far from the model of an ascetic, unworldly prioress. Full well she sung the servicer divine, intuned in her nose full seemily. Although Chaucer's monk and friar show little more inclination for scholarship than the fulfillment of their religious vows, it was the church that preserved learning and undertook to educate young men. The clerk of Oxenford, Chaucer notes, preferred to possess 20 books of Aristotle's philosophy bound in black and red, rather than have new clothes or sufficient food. The universities of Oxford and Cambridge had been founded to train men for the church and for high offices. Students had to meet many requirements and were expected to pursue their studies seriously. As a 15th century regulation declares, each and every student selected for our Royal College at Cambridge must be a poor and indigent clerk who has received the first tonsure, who habitually shows his rank by his good manners, who has an adequate knowledge of grammar, leads a virtuous life, is fitted to be a scholar, and desires to advance in his studies. Because medieval learning was controlled by the church, philosophy and science were firmly fitted into a Christian framework. The architect of the universe, the author of nature, and the first cause of all was God. Man, God's chief creation, was thought to dwell at the center of the universe, on the round earth, round being the shape which symbolized perfection. Everything in the universe was believed to be composed of four elements: earth, water, air, and fire. And each element had its counterpart in the bodily humors of man. The human body, which was seen as a replica in miniature of the universe, was composed of a mixture of these four elements or humors. A man's character and appearance were governed by a combination of humors. And the constellation in the sky at a person's birth determined the dominant humor. Thus, the signs of the zodiac served to reveal a man's character and fate. Chaucer accepted the influence of the humors and the stars on men's lives and referred to them in the description of his pilgrims. In the 14th century, reading your stars was not an idle superstition, but a complicated and esteemed science. Astrology was important to medieval medicine, too, for diagnosis could be made only by someone like Chaucer's doctor of physic, who was grounded in astronomy and knew which humor was in excess in his patient. Surgery was crude, for the study of anatomy requires dissection, which was forbidden by the church. Because the cause of maladies was often unknown, cures were largely unscientific. The man with a toothache is advised by one remedy to make a candle from various herbs, incense and beeswax, then to hold the mouth over it, and you shall see the worms come out of the teeth, and do so often, and you shall be cured. The wife of Bath, as Chaucer describes her, was gap-toothed, but not as a result of toothache. Her appearance and character were closely related, and both were determined by the planets which presided at her birth. In the prologue to her tale, she says, "Venus gave me my lust, my lecherousness, and Mars gave me my sturdy hardiness. Alas, alas, that ever love was sin. I followed I mine inclination by virtue of my constellation." The church had a strong hold over the consciences of its people and exhorted them to pious deeds as much by threats of the horrors of hell as by promises of heavenly rewards. In the Middle Ages, men lavished their fortunes, energy, and ingenuity on building great cathedrals, many of which still stand today as outstanding works of architecture and expressions of belief. The many spires of the cathedrals, abbeys, and churches were the triumphant expression of the medieval Christian's faith. Religion found expression not only in architecture, but also in the art and literature of the Middle Ages, for it was a way of life and a habit of thought. The Canterbury Pilgrims would have been but one of many bands which travelled through the south of England to the shrine of St. Thomas. The influence of the church, reflected in this illuminated initial from a religious manuscript, seldom prevented Englishmen from enjoying material things. Chaucer himself shared the lusty spirit of the times. But at the end of his life, he began to feel that his poetry had been too much concerned with worldly vanities. Before his death in 1400, Chaucer wrote a leave-taking, in which he begged the reader to discount every one of his writings that did not treat of moral virtue or religion. Fortunately, Chaucer did not order his carefully hand-copied manuscripts to be destroyed. Chaucer's accomplishments are the more remarkable when one remembers that he was a pioneer in using his native language instead of the literary French or Latin for his poetry. The verdict of later generations was expressed by the poet Dryden when he described Chaucer as a man of most wonderful, comprehensive nature, because he has taken into the compass of his Canterbury Tales the various manners and humours of the whole English nation. We have our forefathers and great-granddames all before us as they were in Chaucer's days. Their general characters are still remaining in mankind.